Blog Talk Radio.
He's one of the most expressive cinematic artists of our time. He's created a wealth of indelible moments, scenes, and characters that will live as long as there are movies. Well into his fourth decade as a filmmaker, director Brian De Palma remains a risk-taking innovator. And yet, among critics especially, he remains one of the most polarizing figures in the landscape of modern cinema. Tonight, Brian De Palma's friends, collaborators, and admirers help the movie geeks pay tribute to this incredible artist as we explore both the man and his catalog of remarkable films.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, in a special two-hour episode, the Movie Geeks pay tribute to master director Brian De Palma with special guest Eyal Peretz, author of the upcoming book Becoming Visionary, Brian De Palma's Cinematic Education of the Senses, Carey actor and the greatest American hero himself, William Catt, De Palma's friend and longtime colleague from Phantom of the Paradise to the Black Dahlia, actor William Finley, the creator of the De Palma Alamode Appreciation Site, De Palma enthusiast and musician Jeff Baran, and a critical roundtable with one of America's leading film critics from the New York Press, Armand White. If you have questions for any of tonight's guests, you can email them to moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. And now, let the celebration begin. Strap in, turn it up, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, a very special two-hour show where we pay tribute to one of our favorite directors, Brian De Palma. I'm one of your hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie.
I'm Jerry.
And I'm Chris.
And we're really, really pleased to bring you this show tonight. Just a couple of notes before we get started. If you have any questions for any of the guests on this evening, you can email them to moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. We have a lot of phone lines that are going to be used this evening, so unfortunately we probably won't be able to accept any callers. But you can always email us at that email address, and we'll be checking it throughout the show. Also, you can subscribe to our show by iTunes. We're now available. We have our own page. We're big time, guys, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I mean,
don't
this
you feel
is
a
big
sense
news.
Of accomplishment? Like you've arrived. So subscribe to our show through iTunes, and you can download for free all of our past broadcasts as well. All right, so let's get it started. You guys all set?
I am.
Okay, we begin tonight's broadcast with Eyal Peretz. Mr. Peretz received his B.A. in Comparative Literature and Philosophy from Tel Aviv University and his Ph.D. in Comparative Literature from Yale University. He's performed extensive research on 19th and 20th century French and American literature and culture, continental philosophy, psychoanalytic theory, literary theory, and film theory. He currently teaches comparative literature at Indiana University, and his publications include Literature, Disaster, and the Enigma of Power, a reading of Moby Dick, and the forthcoming Becoming Visionary, Brian De Palma's Cinematic Education of the Senses. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Eyal Peretz. Mr. Peretz, let me see if I can mute him here. Mr. Peretz, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
I want to get right to this. You say that you believe that De Palma is essentially a philosophical filmmaker. Now, why do you think the works of De Palma are so ideal for this kind of exploration?
Well, I mean, the question, of course, is what you understand by philosophy. And, I mean, we don't need to get too much into it, but in general, I guess philosophy is not a field that is interested in any specific thing or this or that, any phenomenon, but uh-huh. in our general ways of making sense or understanding how things mean to us.
Right.
And in this sense, I was interested in De Palma, precisely because it seemed to me a cinematic, a director that investigates in a very rigorous manner, in a methodical manner, the way that film itself as a medium makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so, I mean, this was, if you want, I mean, the immediate reason. And on top of being a philosophical filmmaker in this sense, that is investigating the medium of film mm-hmm. and the way it makes sense, he seemed to me a very pedagogical filmmaker. That is kind of that someone who teaches you precisely how to think about the medium of film in such a way.
Yeah. Why do you believe that he's such a polarizing figure for so many American critics and certain audiences?
Yes, that's a good question that I've been, I mean, thinking quite a bit about. I mean, on many levels, I can't answer it because I don't understand. But I think on an essential and or conceptual level, it seems to me that it has to do precisely with the emphasis of his film on the question of the philosophy called the question of the image.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in the philosophical tradition, there is, I mean, from its beginning, basically, with Plato, there is a certain suspicion of something that philosophy called the image.
Mm-hmm.
Where for Plato, it is not, the image is always to be distinguished from the real thing. And the image is the way for Plato in which the real thing is seen. So in philosophy, there is a distinction between what something is and the way that it is seen, and the way that it is seen is considered not real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems to me that De Palma, and this is, again, part of his implication with the philosophical tradition, is precisely is interested in reversing or in criticizing these philosophical hierarchies, and is interested in what it is that we call an image.
Yeah.
Or what it means that something is seen. So the question is, what are these things that we call images, paintings, etc., film? It seems to me that all of De Palma's work is basically an investigation of this question.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that, you asked about why this is so polarizing, it seems to me that to an extent our thinking about art is still very much dominated by a certain Platonic way of thinking, and we suspect everything that declares itself to be only an image rather than the thing itself or a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
So De Palma's films always seem to declare themselves as images rather than realistic depictions of life. And to an extent, I think, especially American movie criticism, is still very much under the domination of realism. That is, they want film to depict a reality of the world that is external to the film.
Yeah.
While De Palma is interested in the question of the image. So his films always have a feeling of artificiality to them,
mm-hmm.
I think. And they always seem to be non-realistic. Not about real life. His characters are not real people as often. I mean, obviously, I don't think it's true, but I mean, I think he looks at them in such a way that alienates many people who look for realism.
But he does find quite a few truthful moments in all of his.
Absolutely, films. He's a director that is interested most of all about in the truth.
Uh-huh.
And he's a director who wants to examine this philosophical category also, which is the truth. But for him, the truth is not something that is opposed to the image, but something to an extent that the image can actually reveal to us.
Yes, yes.
While for philosophy, the image is something that actually prevents us from seeing the truth.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people don't understand this maneuver of De Palma to show that truth is something that can only be revealed inside the image.
Well, that goes with something that I've always felt about his work, and one of the main criticisms against his from his naysayers is that he's too concerned with style over substance. But for me, his substance is his style.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, all there in the style.
And absolutely, and precisely this opposition, style versus substance, is precisely the philosophical opposition between, let's say, the real thing, which I mentioned of Plato, and the image.
Mm-hmm.
To imply that style is separated from substance is precisely to try to separate the image as something. Style is another way, a word, if you want, for what philosophy called the image. So
mm-hmm.
it's something that this. And substance is, of course, is a very essential philosophical word. So to say that style is, that the panel is about style rather than substance is precisely to say that he's about the image rather than the object of which the image is an image.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still a very traditional way of thinking. So you're completely right, precisely, that the style is the substance.
Well, your book pays... I'm sorry. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, I was just agreeing with you that the separation of style and substance is a very traditional philosophical separation that De Palma precisely wants to criticize.
Absolutely. Your book pays significant attention to four De Palma films in particular,
mm-hmm.
and I want to discuss some of your thoughts on each of these films, starting with Carrie.
Sure.
You examine the first two scenes in particular detail, the volleyball match and the shower scene where the lead character begins her menstrual cycle.
Mm-hmm.
What do these two scenes tell us about the themes of the film and the kind of motifs that consume so much of De Palma's later work?
Right. As I said, my general question was always in what is De Palma's understanding of the medium of film? What is it the medium of film can show us? And my interest in Carrie was to start, which was the first film I investigated, was to start to understand what De Palma, how De Palma sees the relation between the medium of film and the question of horror. And what is it that someone sees, let's say, I think that all of De Palma's films basically are about the question where when someone, the hero or the heroine, sees something that is too much or too painful for them or too horrifying for them.
Very true.
And it's about seeing something. And this seeing something is the place from which seeing something that is too much and that we don't understand is the place from which his cinema opens, and it's also what he thinks that the cinematic image, I think, shows us. The cinematic image shows us something that kind of is too much for our understanding.
Right.
And I was interested in Carrie, precisely to the extent that immediately beginning with the first scene and with the way in which the camera moves, the camera enacts an event of seeing something that is incomprehensible. And that the camera movement itself shows us something incomprehensible in this sense. I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, of the volleyball scene that opens
right.
it, and that scene's roughly 45 seconds.
Right.
You write on his interpretation of the camera. You say there's always great danger and menacing potential lurking in the camera's movement, that the camera will stop on you, choose you, arrest you, and frame you. Now, in relation to that volleyball scene, what exactly do you? How is that illustrated?
Okay, yeah. So what I was trying to think there is the way in which this opening scene brings to the fore a movement of the camera where we don't know who is responsible for the movement. The camera moves,
mm-hmm.
but it is not clear why it moves. What is the motivation for its movement? We cannot assign its movement to any of the participants in the film.
It has no kind of defined point of view.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it is precisely not having a defined point of view and not being what I call motivated that introduces what I claim to be a certain horror of the image. I mean, this is the first step, but it seemed to me a crucial step. So already it seemed to me that in the first scene of Carrie, there is a relation between the unmotivated movement of the camera that gives a certain ghostly or eerie effect, and the way in which the camera's movement stops at the end of the scene on Carrie's face, and she then becomes the scapegoat for this movement, or becomes the one who is accused precisely of something in the world that moved in a way which was unexplainable,
mm-hmm.
which is, of course, what she always does eventually.
Right, right.
And I wanted to and it seemed to me that the transition from this first scene in which Carrie becomes a scapegoat to an incomprehensible movement to the second scene where Carrie's wounding or bleeding is a certain, if you want, actualization or literalization of what happened in the first scene.
Mm-hmm. I found that very fascinating, the what you wrote on that shower scene. Particularly something that's occurred several times, including in The Fury, in De Palma's work, where when she discovers the blood and she comes out of the shower and she reaches out with blood-soaked hands to Amy Irving's character. And Amy Irving, in a sense, becomes the witness to Carrie. And she sets out, as a result, she's inspired to set out to try to change things for Carrie. And that it doesn't quite work out, as we see by the end of the film. But that's kind of a recurring motif of the witness in De Palma's films, too, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. There's always a moment of transmitting something that is incomprehensible. This is what the witness is. The witness is, if you want, the receiver of some of the image, if you want, of this this something that you see that is incomprehensible to you, but you can only transmit further because it is incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
This is also, I think, De Palma's relation, if you want, to Hitchcock, which is another, and obviously, one of the main questions of De Palma. That De Palma is, in this sense, is to an extent, if you want, this is one, it seems to me, of the categories to think of his relation to Hitchcock, that he's a witness of something in Hitchcock that is incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
And his cinema is a cinema that witnesses kind of something that Hitchcock discovered, but which kind of De Palma receives, as if something incomprehensible in Hitchcock, De Palma has to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a relation between the question of repetition, if you want, and the question of witnessing. We repeat or we witness also what we can. We witness what the other transmits to us because he or she does not understand it, and we have to repeat it also because we ourselves don't understand it.
You know,
so there's an essential dimension of repetition in De Palma's cinema, a repetition of, if you want, also of Hitchcock and of a lot of the history of film. And precisely, I think this is the logic that motivates it.
Well, you say something else about Carrie in the notes section of your book. You say the arrest of the camera is revealed as a powerful political tool that can be used to create communities of exclusion. I think we've touched upon that somewhat here. I mean, it goes to express. That's why I find Carrie such a deeply felt film.
Absolutely.
Because
I find all of De Palma deeply felt.
Yeah, because his camera is absolutely motivated by who Carrie is. And it, like you say, when it creates these communities of exclusion, that's illustrating that point, isn't it?
The communities of exclusion, I mean, it's part of De Palma's understanding of cinema as a political critique, that the certain power, what I wanted to say, that the certain power to manipulate, let's say, the camera or to decide where it stops or where it doesn't, then creates meaning that can be used, let's say, to exclude people.
Mm-hmm.
For example, at the end of the first scene, I claim that the camera's arrest on Carrie precisely is an accusative arrest. And of we also are made as audience and also the people in the game, the other girls in the game, are made to view Carrie as responsible for this horrifying dimension that we unconsciously felt or sensed.
Yeah.
So this is what I meant by political tool, that we, to an extent, I mean, De Palma shows us how we become also part of the accusers of Carrie precisely by through the decision to stop the camera at a certain moment on her face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is then this stop or this arrest of the camera on her face immediately separates her from the rest of the girls and from us, and we all stand and, to an extent, accuse her of something. In this sense, this is community, what I call community of exclusion. Precisely because we can, if you want, accuse her and exclude her from a community, it's one of the ways in which the dimension of horror can be as if avoided in our life because we find someone responsible for it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in your chapter, the chapter of your book that deals with the Fury, you pay close attention to his framing. And, you know, I think that De Palma's framing is possibly, with the exception of Spielberg, I mean, it's unrivaled.
Yes, I agree.
Can you discuss, you talk about the occasional object that kind of interrupts and confuses the frame. Can you discuss the first example of this that you use on the beach and how that manifests itself throughout the course of the film?
Right. So what I was interested in the Fury, again, I mean, in the main category of any category, if you want, that interested me, is, again, the category of the cinematic frame, mm-hmm. and precisely the cinematic frame, if you want, that by that kind of two relations of the cinematic frame. One, its activity precisely, let's say, of framing or of cutting a certain part of the world to the exclusion of all others. And that's kind of like attempting to, if you want, to artificially contain the world or to make the world comprehensible by setting its limits.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, within the frame in the Palma film, especially in all his films that I was interested in the Fury, within the frame, there's always remains a certain, if you want, like a stain or a trace of something that is itself cannot be explained within the categories that the frame itself tried to set.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you're asking about, which at the beginning of the Fury, has to do precisely with the very opening. With the very opening shot, where I mean, the camera it first shows the father and the son, I mean, swimming towards the beach, and finally going out of the water and falling on the beach, and then kind of the camera stops, and they are kind of framed in a certain way. The whole picture seems kind of comprehensible, but then we notice that at the bottom right hand of the frame, there is something that is, to an extent, incomprehensible to us. There is some stain. We don't exactly understand what's going on. Something is interrupting mm-hmm. the frame. And then in the next shot, we realize that it is the toe of John Cassavetes, who plays Childress,
right,
in the film. And my interest was in showing that the whole film basically is kind of structured around the way in kind of constant attempts to reframe and kind of to chase away a certain stain that prevented the frame from constructing completely, if you want, coherent reality.
Mm-hmm.
As a reflection on the cinematic medium, it seemed to me that it kind of, so what he's trying to show is the way in which the frame, to an extent, always fails. There's some stain in it. But then, precisely, you try to give this stain a certain meaning so you can understand how to read the frame. And then you say that its meaning is that it is kind of a certain evil force that is responsible for the breaking of the frame. So here there's a certain fantasy I'm claiming of an evil dimension, call it Childress here, that is precisely a name for the way that the frame is interrupted or made incomprehensible. Precisely in the same way, the opposite, that in Carrie, I mean, immediately one looks for a certain scapegoat to be responsible for a dimension of incomprehension or horror that enters the world.
Mm-hmm.
But my claim in the Fury was that De Palma is interested actually, on the one hand, in examining this mechanism, but more interestingly, perhaps, because this is a mechanism I think that was examined before, more interestingly, that he's trying to also show a cinema that does not behave according to this type of attempts of framing and chasing away the world, but a different type of cinema that I call a visionary cinema that I associate with the figure of Gillian.
Mm-hmm. Examination of blowout for me mm-hmm. for me blowout seems to be I think Pauline Kael said this too. De Palma's most kind of complete film, like everything he had learned from the suspense genre, kind of culminated into blowout.
Right. Absolutely, yeah.
You talk about his use of split screen and blowout in the scene where he overhears the news on the television as he works in the background in the sound studio. He's one of the only directors I know of that utilizes split screen anymore. What is he able to express using the split screen device, particularly in this scene?
Right. Yeah, again, I mean, De Palma is not the first director who uses split screen, etc., but I do think he's probably the director who used it in the most philosophical manner. There was kind of trying to regard it as a device that specifically captures something that film can show us. And again, the split screen, it can be related to the question of the frame we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And precisely, the split is something that prevents the screen from being completely occupied by a single frame. Right? So the split is a split into two frames.
Mm-hmm.
And once kind of the world, or kind of once it is this splitting, if you want, that here functions, I think, in a very similar manner to the way I described the toe as functioning. That is, as showing us a certain disturbance of the unified space of the screen that was occupied by a single frame.
Right.
So the split screen here is like an intrusion or interruption. I mean, what is interesting is not so much one or the other of the frames, but the split. That there is a dimension that cannot be contained in either of the frames, but causes the fact that there cannot be only one frame, if you want.
Right.
So this it is, and it's the activity of splitting that is interesting. That is the activity that kind of makes the unity of the frame and the unity of the screen to an extent break.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's safe to say The Blowout is probably one of his darkest films.
Yes.
And what's interesting to me about Femme Fatale, which is the last film that you examine in your book, is that he seems to find, I think you use these words, he seems to finally have been able to find a happiness in the suspense genre.
Right.
Is that what you find revelatory about Femme Fatale?
I mean, I think De Palma from the beginning has constantly struggled with attempting to find, if you want, a happy ending which is not false,
mm-hmm.
Or to find a dimension of an ending that, if you want, is redemptive,
right.
But that will not ring false as most happy endings do. And for him, in this sense, I think that a happy ending is essentially tied to the question of horror that I talked about. That is, the two questions I talked about, the question of horror and the question of the cinematic image. The cinematic image for him, I claim, is something that always reveals what I call something that is too much for us, or too painful, or too horrifying for us. And a happy ending would be a certain successful way of, if you want, dealing with what the cinematic image brought to our life. And Femme Fatale seemed to be, to me, to be perhaps his, or a particularly successful way, or perhaps his most rigorous attempt at constructing a movie that is fully about the question of, if you want, the image in a very explicit manner,
uh-huh.
and it shows the question of the image to contain a certain dimension of fear or horror involved in it. I'll explain it in a second, and also to finally try to find a way to turn this horror of the image around and to make it a source for a certain possibility of redemptive ending.
Right, right.
So let's say the question of the image I was claiming is dealt with in Femme Fatale, of course, in the way that she herself is afraid of her image being taken, right? She's, the heroine is someone who is constantly attempts to hide from photographers, and in this sense she's kind of displaying a certain originary fear of precisely that De Palma explores in all his films, of someone's image being taken or of being exposed to this eye of the camera. And at the end, precisely, there is a certain miracle that allows her to, if you want, be liberated from this fear of the image.
Right.
But part of the allegorical dimensions there, another word for the image, I mean, in the Palma is the word double.
Mm-hmm.
The double is also someone who is like the image, right? It's our double, someone that is exactly like us, but there is something different. It's not us, if you want. It's our being, if you want, seen. So all of the Palma film obviously always contain the figure of the double, that is another figure for what they call the image, right? Because the image is basically something that doubles us.
Right, right.
So what interested me in Femme Fatale is the way that the Palma managed to turn the double from the double, that is kind of, which is a figure of the image, managed to turn it from something that is horrifying or kind of is something that is the cause of doom. Let's say there's a whole tradition, romantic tradition, where the double is always someone who announces your death. If you see your double, basically means you're going to die. So here there is what seemed to me the brilliant stroke of Femme Fatale was that the double is actually someone who finally allows the heroine to be liberated from her fear or from a horror and to start a new life precisely through this gift that she gives her of a crystal ball that is at the origin of a certain kind of chain of events that liberates her.
Yeah.
So it seemed to me that the Palma was here precisely trying to think, and I think in a very brilliant way, is precisely in what way the double can turn from a source of our horror to a source of redemption, if you want.
Yeah, and it does seem to be a theme that he's been trying to find, like you said, and not in a false manner, try to find throughout his career, and especially his work in the suspense genre. I wish
absolutely. Obsession, I guess, is a very striking way in which De Palma tried to forge a happy ending. I think this is also part of his relation to Hitchcock, that Hitchcock, it seems to me, that the late Hitchcock, which is the Hitchcock that interests De Palma, has never really found a way for a happy ending, if you want.
Right.
I mean, the early Hitchcock, I mean, of course, is full of happy endings, but which later Hitchcock obviously does not find convincing. And on some level, if Vertigo is the film that occupies De Palma the most,
yes.
What he's interested in is precisely, if you want, to show that there is a different cinematic adventure possible than the one that Vertigo ends with.
Mm-hmm.
So Femme Fatale, is, like many of the Palma films, is also, of course, a rewriting of Vertigo, but precisely by trying to find another way out.
Right.
If you want.
Right. I wish we had more time. You've written a fantastic book, and it's filled with such a wealth of ideas, and I could speak for hours to you exploring it, but unfortunately we don't have that luxury. But your book gets released in October. Can our listeners pre-order it anywhere?
Yes, I think you can already pre-order it on Amazon.
Okay. It is Becoming Visionary, Brian De Palma's Cinematic Education of the Senses, and I would recommend that everyone go to Amazon right now and find it and pre-order it. It is well worth your time for any movie lover and any fan of De Palma specifically. Mr. Peretz, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it so much. You take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Eyal Peretz. His book is called Becoming Visionary, Brian De Palma's Cinematic Education of the Senses, and it's a fantastic book. We're waiting on William Catt to call in. His interview time is at 6:30. What do you guys think about that?
Fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, it's a fantastic book, but it's one of those books that make me wish that I was smarter.
You're smarter. Don't sell yourself short. I've talked to you many times. You're very smart. Don't even sell yourself short like that.
No. I have to, you know, because you're used to, I guess it's the curse of television, reality television and everything. It kind of numbs your brain. And I think that's a big reason why some people are critical of Brian De Palma, because you can't be a lazy movie watcher and appreciate De Palma's works.
No, that's true.
There's a lot going on. It's very complex. So you know, just like reading that book, it was it's very intelligent, very detailed analysis of his works. I had to read it through like three or four times just to just to make sure I had a grasp of those concepts.
You had a very good grasp.
It was a little humiliating.
They're all going to laugh at you.
Thank you. Yeah. And
great. Piper, Laurie, and Brian De Palma's father, mother, never far from us. Okay, wonderful.
Yes, yes. While we're waiting for Mr. Cat to call in, let me give you a little background on De Palma leading up to Carrie. De Palma was born, actually, on September 11th in 1940 in New York, New Jersey. And he had a, it's been reported that he had a tumultuous relationship with his parents and older brothers, to say the least. And I think you can fairly deduce that his pictures, depictions of inferiority and suffocation kind of emanate from this childhood experience. And he was primarily influenced by Citizen Kane and Vertigo and the works of Godard, who informed much of his earliest comedic work. A lot of people don't realize that his earliest work was in the comedy vein, in the satire, like really sharp satire. And it's still present in a lot of his suspense films, certainly, as well. And we had Keith Ulick on last week, and he spoke of those early films just briefly. And let me play that clip for you.
A lot of people who hate him see him as derivative of Hitchcock, and people who love him tend to defend it, as just Hitchcock being an influence and such. For me, though, you know, that's sort of like, not seeing the forest for the trees, really. It's just, it's one facet of his personality, and I think people base it mainly because I think a lot of people think of Carrie as being his first movie, kind of like I think a lot of people might think of Jaws as being Spielberg's first movie, when they were heavily involved in things before them. And De Palma comes out of a very politically minded cinema, I think, that he's often cited Jean-Luc Godard as a big influence for him. And if you look at films like Greetings and Hi Mom, and especially Hi Mom, I think you can see Godardian traits and tactics and other things in terms of how politically minded his films are. And I don't think the political has gone away, even in his thrillers.
De Palma is actually unique among his contemporaries because he, and I think Mr. Perrette spoke to this briefly, he always kind of makes you aware that you're watching a film, and yet he never fails to keep you emotionally involved. And after making 7 short films, he directed his first feature film, Murder a la Mode, in 1968, followed by the comedy Greetings, starring Robert De Niro, that same year. And then he shot The Wedding Party the following year, 1969, and Hi Mom the year after, which were 2 more biting comedies, and they both starred De Niro as well. I mean, people don't realize, but I think it's pretty safe to say that De Palma brought De Niro into the film. I mean,
yes,
cinematic mainstream with those early pictures.
I mean, he did, especially with Hi Mom. I think is a career a pre Travis Bickle, Mean Streets moment, pre Scorsese moment for De Niro. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, and just a highly touted satire of a lot of things. I think was it Hi Mom or was it Greetings that kind of satirized race? Was it?
It's Hi Mom is more race. Greetings is more about the draft dodging.
The draft, right. Well, his first feature drama was Dionysus in 1970. And his first suspense picture was, I guess you could say it was Sisters in 1973. And the two films that followed pre-Carrie were the crazy musical Phantom of the Paradise, which we'll be discussing in just a few minutes with actor Bill Finley, who was actually a lead role in that film and has been in several of De Palma's films. And Obsession, which we mentioned earlier. For right now, what do we think of these early De Palma films pre-Carrie, which Carrie, of course, turned out to be his first major box office hit? But what's your take on those early films, starting with you, Jerry?
Well, I think the early ones, especially the ones that are influenced by Godard, and there's definitely, I see it in Greetings and I see it in Hi Mom. I definitely see that influence. And the comedy's there, too, and it's very important, I think, for his detractors, for people who aren't crazy about him, to go back and watch those films, because I think they will have a better appreciation of where he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is important to go back, because they're very, for the times, and I remember watching Greetings, I guess Greetings must have been in the mid-90s on Bravo, they played it late one night, and when I saw who it was directed by, I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about these early films until really the late 90s, really, and they're very eye-opening experiences to watch.
What were some of your impressions of those early films, like Phantom of the Paradise and such, Chris?
Well, I love Phantom of the Paradise. It's the way you describe it is the perfect way to describe it. It's a crazed musical.
Yeah.
And, I think that the people that are making musicals today, like Dreamgirls in Chicago and, Hairspray, and those are fine movies, but they're very safe. You know, a movie like Hedwig and the Angry Inch, for instance, owes a lot to a movie like Phantom of the Paradise. It's kind of a musical for people that don't like musicals.
And also the Rocky Horror Picture owes a lot to
That's true. That's another good example, yeah.
Absolutely. And Sisters, for me, Sisters kind of announced the arrival of De Palma to this genre. It's one of those, there's so many images and moments in his films that are just burned in my brain because they play so hyper-real, almost dreamlike, and they just leave an imprint on you. And Sisters, when the next morning after she sleeps with the fellow game show contestant at the very beginning, and he's bringing her a birthday cake, and she's under the covers, and
right.
As he approaches, she comes out with a knife and starts slicing. And it is such a shock to the system. that
yes,
moment,
it is.
It is so horrifying. And like the best suspense directors and horror directors, like we discussed last week, you don't feel safe, you know. And I think that really announced his arrival into this genre in a big way. I'm a huge fan of Sisters, and of course I'm a big fan of Carrie. And unfortunately, William Catt has not called in. He was slated for 6:30, and we had confirmation and the whole thing, but possibly he got tied up. So. We will attempt to get Mr. Catt on in a future broadcast, but in just a few minutes we'll have Mr. Finley joining us. But let's talk about Carrie for a little bit.
Okay.
Carrie, for me, seems so, like I said before, deeply felt, because I think all of us have a bit of Carrie in us, the outsider.
Right.
And I certainly think that De Palma had it and sympathized deeply with that character. But why do you think it's such an effective film? What about the film works for you, Chris?
The film works for me, and I don't want to discount De Palma's credits, but it's important to remember, too, that it was a Stephen King book, and
right.
It was a really good Stephen King book. So, you know, De Palma is working with a great source material there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, arguably, I think it's the best interpretation of a Stephen King book to date, and it's no secret that there's plenty of film interpretations of his books, and they usually don't
pan out.
That. No, it doesn't work the same as the book. Somehow that magic doesn't transfer onto the screen, but in Carrie it does. So
yeah.
That's one of the really unique things. And not only was it a success then, it holds up now. It's still scary.
Yes, it is.
It's still a good movie, and it's the kind of movie like I had never read Carrie before I saw it. The movie made me want to go back and read the book. I go back and read the book, and then I go back and watch the movie, and they make each other,
they complement each other.
Yeah, they do complement each other. It's a good interpretation of the book. So it's a
yeah.
difficult thing to do, and there's plenty of big directors who aren't able to do it. I think he did.
Well, I think it's one of two movies that actually have scared me in my life. The first being Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The
right.
original. But Carrie terrifies me because you're given little clues and hints with her telekinesis throughout, and there's always this impending macabre element.
Right.
But for the most part, it plays like a very smart, very finely observed John Hughes film. I mean, it's not a comedy, obviously, but you really get the sense of what it's like to be a teenager.
Yeah, he gets that right. He does get that very right.
Yeah, among all the classmates, and then you feel enormous amounts of sympathy for Carrie and her home life, and what we were talking about last week, where you're not able to orientate yourself. You're not sure what to feel in those scenes with the mother because they're funny, because Piper Laurie's playing it so outlandishly. And they're
for a good reason, though, she's playing it out.
Oh, absolutely. She's phenomenal in the movie, and I wouldn't want her to play in any other way. And Sissy Spacek is so, you know, her performance is like an open wound. It's so raw, and you feel for her, and at the same time, you're terrified too. So it's all these combating emotions, you know, and I don't think people are used to experiencing that in the film. And by the time it ends at the prom, and the film goes to hell, essentially, I mean, it is it's so such a catharsis and so visceral. It really works for me, and I watched it again for probably the 9th, 10th time last week, and it still holds up just like the first time I viewed it. What are your thoughts on Carrie, Jerry?
Well, Carrie hits close to home if you know about De Palma's relationship with his parents, and you know his feelings towards his mother have not ebbed at all. I mean, just watch The Black Dahlia, and that with this the great scene where they were introduced to Hilary Swank's family.
Mm-hmm.
No love is lost between him and the relationship between his mother, and I think Piper Laurie is a hellacious but incredible stand-in for Mrs. De Palma. He really, in this novel, where he was hired on, but he greatly identified. You could say that Carrie is the first of many of the weak, but who eventually gained strength, like Keith Gordon later on in Home Movies and Dressed to Kill, that
mm-hmm.
weak protagonist who gained strength. But he identified very strongly with this book. He found elements in there of his own home life, and it's there on full display.
Yeah, and he had a lot of pre-production time,
yes.
Apparently trying to get the financing. So he had the film visually mapped out. He said it was the most kind of prepared film he's ever done visually.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it shows.
Shows
with our conversation with Mr. Peretz, too. The camera just absolutely is motivated by the emotions of the characters.
That prom scene still gives me the creeps.
Yeah, yeah, and proms are terrifying anyway.
Well, but no, that really gives it that whole...
With or without the pig blood.
Yeah, with it. I mean, it's just always the scenes, you know what's going down, and every time you watch it or when you read the book, I read the book a couple times too, and you just know what's coming, and it still works.
Yeah.
I can't say that about a lot of movies.
And Jerry, you're actually a big fan of Obsession.
I am a big fan of Obsession, and we've been talking about this film for years in this household, but it's like, I guess everyone wants to say, his naysayers, oh, it's his ripoff of Vertigo. And that's true to an extent, but it is the first time and that he does achieve the happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not under the best circumstances. And what we talked about last night, there was another ending that Paul Schrader wanted to add on. Brian De Palma said, no, that will ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting story there, but... No, the movie, I think, works very well, and I think the music is, Bernard Herrmann's score is perfect.
I think it's the last time they worked together.
Yeah, and it's a wonder, it's just a really tightly, it's also, I think, one of the shorter De Palma films in the thriller genre, too, but it's also, I think, the first time we see John Lithgow, this evolution of John Lithgow's character in each film. Then we go to Blowout, where he's more demented, and Raising Cain, where he's 110% demented. But it's Obsession is the first of these many films where, and as sisters, we see the Hitchcock Obsession. It becomes more, but it's not that he's ripping off Hitchcock. He obviously found stuff in Hitchcock that he identified with very strongly,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing wrong with that.
And,
every director, Hitchcock channeled himself many times.
And then you made mention of something too, or you'll make mention of something too during the Jeff Baran interview. Where some directors that will go unnamed until that interview get praised for this sort of thing, and De Palma gets crucified for it. But, you know, he's exploring some similar themes to Hitchcock, and I hope to examine this with Armand White later on in the show. But, you know, his approach is different. What he does with these themes, where he takes them, is different. And I don't see what people... It's a very dismissive comment.
Yes, it is.
And by someone that doesn't want to take the time to really think it through. You know, it's easy just to say Hitchcock clone. And
It's very easy to say that. It's still wrong.
Yeah, but that's just not even scratching the surface of
right.
what De Palma's films are. In terms of what De Palma film means the most to you personally, what would you say that is, Jerry?
Which film?
Or which De Palma film? What do you consider to be his ultimate time vault film? If someone had never heard of De Palma, you had to show them one film to represent why you love De Palma. Which one would it be?
I'd have to go with Blowout.
Yeah.
After all I've watched, even, I would really still have to go with Blowout after all these years.
What about you, Chris?
Personally, I mean, the two that I love, I think Blowout and Raising Kane. I think Raising Kane's really an underrated work from him, and I think it's
truly
him in top form. And I remember seeing the movie when it first came out and being, you know, a little bit confused. I mean, I was pretty young. I think I was like 13 when it came out, and my parents took me to see it because we all, my family's
old
a lot
right
like
now.
my family's a lot like your family, Jerry. We all love De Palma.
Yeah,
and my family. So we all went and saw it. I remember thinking that it wasn't, you know, up to par with Blowout and with Dressed to Kill. But the more I watch it over the years, the more I feel like he's never been more sure-handed than he is in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true.
And it's got the scenes that just terrify me, like the girl coming up as the car goes under the water, and you know, her hands on the back on the windshield, and just that haunting image always terrifies me. That would be the one I'd put in the time
vault. That's a good one.
And that's something that Mr. Perret says in his book as well. You know, De Palma is an artist, and works of art cannot be completely appreciated and understood upon first viewing. And I think that De Palma's films really benefit from repeated viewing.
They do.
Yeah, at first you might be just taken by the surface nature of it, by the uninterrupted shots or the technical wizardry of it, the fluid camera and the different devices he uses. But then watch it again and see what those devices and different movements and things are in the service of, what they are trying to express. And I think The Raising Kane is a phenomenal film. For me, my two De Palma favorites, and I don't know if I can choose between them if I had to choose one, would be Carrie and Blowout. Carrie just because I feel such an emotional connection to it, and Blowout just because it's just a phenomenal piece of filmmaking.
Right.
I mean, it is so accomplished, and it is the summation of everything I think De Palma is great at, excels at. So we're waiting for Mr. Finley to call in. His interview time is scheduled at 6:50. But until then, we need to explore some other De Palma films. You know, he's worked outside of the suspense genre, obviously, in films like Scarface and The Untouchables. These are kind of the big studio director for hire, kind of, if you want to classify them.
Right.
Films. And it's very it's very interesting how he segues into that. We had Stephen Bauer on the show a few weeks ago, last month, for our Al Pacino tribute. And he said a little something about why Scarface, more than any other film I can remember, and certainly more than any film in De Palma's resume, has resonated so greatly more than 20 years after its initial release. Let's hear what Stephen Bauer had to say here.
Oh, man. You know why? Because it was so wild what we were doing. You know what's great is that all the elements were in place. It's one of those, like, magical things. Here's the deal. You get this great story, right? That's there. That's a classic, the story itself. But Oliver's script, because Oliver, being the wild man that he is, had been here, had been in Miami in those years in the early 80s, and had seen and hung out with the bad guys as well as the good guys.
Right.
You know, he did. He mixed with the criminals and the crime and the police. You know, and the law enforcement guys, he hung out with them because he's like that. You know, he's like, he wants to get in, you know, and like soak it all up. And that he did. So he got a lot of the language. He got some of the stuff. That's where he got the chainsaw idea, because he had heard the story. He had heard that, because there's some crazy things that were done, you know, a lot of violent, you know, crazy violence, in those years. And he put it into the script. So then you have this great cast that comes together, this ensemble chosen, you know, by a very, very astute and very, very a man with great taste of the producer, Marty Bregman, and Brian De Palma, who just had the perfect feel, the perfect sense of style, you know, style, stylistically, he had the perfect, visually, you know, the cinematographer who passed away,
John Lonzo,
and then again, personality wise, you have Brian De Palma knew enough somehow. He knew enough, and he had enough respect for Al, and for the rest of it, and it just passed on to all the actors, the way he dealt with all the actors, that he gave us a lot of room, a lot of freedom to be flamboyant, to be out there on the edge with these characters, to not be careful. So none of the performances are careful or predictable. They're weird. They're kinky. You know, they're kind of quirky.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the performances, I mean, like bang, 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 you know, you meet all these characters, and all the main characters are all kind of quirky and different. You know, they're not archetypes of characters you've seen in American film up to that point.
Yeah.
They're brand new.
Yeah. How do we feel about Scarface and, in general, the other kind of studio projects that he has done, starting with Scarface? Chris, what do you think?
I think that's one of the most interesting things about him. You know, we were talking with Perez about, you know, he is able to go into all this philosophical detail about his movies, and it's true. You can watch De Palma's movies and get that from it. You can enjoy them on an intellectual level, but you can also, if you don't want to watch the movie that way, you can just grab the popcorn and the Milk Duds and sit with your family or your girlfriend and watch it and enjoy it like a popcorn movie. He's one of the most entertaining directors out there. He can go and make something like Mission Impossible, which on the surface, you know, back in 1996 or whatever it was,
yeah, 96.
Seemed like another big summer movie that was coming out. Could have been anybody directing it, but he takes it and elevates it into this. He puts that Brian De Palma flair into it and gives you scenes like stealing the disc at Langley and you know, taking the soundtrack out. There's no sound. I don't know if you remember when you're watching that movie, it was like so silent in there. Usually when there's a silent moment in a movie like that, the audience is restless and you can hear the popcorn and the crunching and people coughing and stuff.
Yeah, Stanley Wheaton Plaza was like that though, unfortunately.
It was totally silent when I watched the movie. I mean, people were just so hooked. He can move around, and that's kind of what we were talking about earlier. He goes with source material. He has this great source material.
That's very true.
Scripts from guys like David Koepp and David Mamet, and books from Stephen King and Tom Wolfe, and he can do it. He can do it like nobody else can.
Yeah, and what's interesting, too, about that Mission Impossible scene, it's very quiet because the audience actually kind of would feel like if they made a noise, it would alarm them that Tom Cruise is in the room. You know, you just empathize so much with this, what's going on the screen. And there was something very interesting that was written about, I don't think it was written about it, it was in a documentary on Rosemary's Baby, and they were talking about something Polanski did with the camera. I think it was Ruth Gordon. Was that the actress that was in Rosemary's Baby? And Harold and Maude.
Yeah, she's in Harold and Maude, yes.
Yeah, and it's the same one that's in Rosemary's Baby,
yeah,
and she's on the phone. She's on the phone in her bedroom, and it's some kind of conspiratorial moment, and the camera is caught in the door frame, and it cuts off half her face while she's on the phone. And she said she attended a screening, and in unison, the entire audience kind of swayed to their right so they could look around that door frame and see what was going on. It's very much the same thing with De Palma. They involve you so visually that they have you in the palm of their hand, and you're just in there. And that's why I think a lot of people focus on the De Palma sequences, particularly in these commercial projects he does, like The Scarface and Untouchables, Carlito's Way, and they seem to be the moments when you can actually hear him laughing with glee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can hear him kind of exhaling and say, "Ah, I can do my thing in this scene." The train station sequence in Carlito's Way.
I think it's a good point.
Yeah, the train station sequence in The Untouchables. I mean, it's gone down to the record books as one of the most unbelievable such sequences of the past like 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. What are your thoughts on some of this work we've been talking about, Jerry?
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned the train sequence with the steps, and that comes straight from the Battleship Potemkin. That scene from Eisenstein's film, I mean, that shows up in a lot of his films, whether it be Blowout, The Untouchables. I think The Untouchables is where it's fully realized.
Mm-hmm.
I think he really, it's where it comes together for him, but it's in Raising Kane, it's in The Black Dahlia, it's in Carlito's Way with the escalators in the subway station.
Right.
He loves the stairs. He loves this iconic piece of film. And
well, yeah.
And he does such wonders with it each time. It is amazing. Even in The Black Dahlia, I'll give him that. It's not a great film, but he manages to get something out of it.
Well, and plus, too, I think most artists are trying to exercise some theme that consumes them throughout the course of their career. It doesn't matter the genre they're working in, doesn't matter what the material is necessarily, there's always some essence, some theme that they keep coming back to and working out.
Right.
And it's not, does he repeat himself, because I don't believe he does.
No.
I think people that just too easily dismiss say that, but what does he discover in that second examination of that theme, or, you know, what does he find that's new? And I think there are discoveries in every De Palma film. Even you're talking about Blowout, or Body Double, rather.
Yes.
When you watched it last night, you gained a new appreciation for it.
I gained a very big appreciation for it. It might seem like to many people, and I know, I mean, besides the drill sequences, a lot of violence at the time. It's also, I have to say, the movie dates itself with the Frankie Goes to Hollywood song that's playing in the middle of it. It dates itself immediately. But there is a very important scene in the first act of the film where the main character, played by Craig Wasson, who is Brian De Palma's stand-in in this film, is in an actor's class. And he is in this, the teacher is making him go through this painful set of events on the stage that is like just an exact duplicate of the famous being hidden behind the refrigerator when there are kids playing hide-and-go-seek with his two older brothers, and he was too scared to call out. He didn't want them to make fun of him. He was stuck behind the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very important event, folks. This informs all of his work, Casualties of War 2. It's there.
Yes, the sense of suffocation.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. So even in the films that don't work 100%, there's always a revelation in them.
Yes.
And plus, you know, you're armed with that knowledge about his childhood experience, and
yes,
probably what informed a lot of his work, and that enriches that film to you.
It makes, yes, it does.
And I think the first thing that you need to be when to appreciate a movie is an empathetic person. You need to be able to.
That's a very good word.
Yeah, to understand and feel what it's like to be in someone else's shoes before you can truly appreciate the experience of a film. And I think that, you know, I can't imagine someone being an empathetic person and not relating to De Palma's works and his characters. And they're so deeply felt, as we've discussed before. We're waiting for Bill Finley to call, and apparently we have two guests that have not called this evening. You know, we've sent out about 175 interview requests for the show, and you know, we got the guest list that we did, and we sent out two confirmations, and they were confirmed. But you never know with these sort of things,
right?
So hopefully we'll have Mr. Finley, and I know that Chris worked hard on the interview.
Yes, he did.
Preparing the interview.
We all worked hard on the interviews, but the great thing is, De Palma is somebody that all three of us love, so if we don't get, you know, if we don't have guests to talk to,
we got ourselves.
About De Palma. Yeah, I could talk about him all night long.
Yeah, we could talk to ourselves about De Palma.
Yes,
we could. We don't need anybody.
Yeah.
All right, Jerry, our next guest is here. If you would like to do the honors, this is your interview right here.
Our next guest is the founder and creator of the website De Palma a la Mode, the ultimate one-stop site for all things Brian De Palma. Opened prior to the release of Snake Eyes in 1998, De Palma a la Mode is a triumph of enthusiasm, class, and cinephilia. I have been going to his site for the better part of a decade for my De Palma fix. Jeff Baran has had the honor and pleasure of interviewing Brian De Palma in 2002, right before the opening of Femme Fatale, and again in 2006 prior to the release of the Black Dahlia. It is our great honor to welcome Jeff Baran to Movie Geeks United. Please give him a big and hearty welcome.
Hey, Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to the show, Jeff. It is an honor to speak to you.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
I'm going to come right out and say it. Why Brian De Palma?
His movies, they blew me away. I started watching them on video. I just started renting some movies. Dressed to Kill, I think, was the first one I saw. Well, I had seen Carrie on television.
Right.
And then Dressed to Kill, Blowout. And then I started, I think I rented Body Double. And then I rented Obsession. And that was the turning point for me. When I watched Obsession and I was kind of watching it and I was into it, but I was like, this is kind of different from the other films. And then the last third of it, when everything turns around, I was hooked to Brian De Palma. I mean, it was just...
I knew I liked you for a reason, and I think you just gave it away. You just gave it all away, and that's beautiful. I love to hear that. Also, the Obsession fans have got to stick together. I would have to say you have a very large commitment to this director, just judging from your website, which I'd like to add to people listening. If you want to know how to do a director's website, this is the one to go to. Beautiful.
Yeah, I try to make it. When I started the site, it's almost been 10 years, just like you said. I was actually on the internet just looking for information on Brian De Palma, and there was hardly anything. There was a little site devoted to him, I think from Canada, not the one that's up there from Canada now. It was a different one. And that was about it, and there was not very much information, especially in comparison to some of the other major directors. And so I just started gathering all the news I could find and just started putting it up, and that's pretty much what I've been doing the whole time.
Well, no, and you've done a great job, and I noticed that that's a great question that De Palma asked you in that interview in the book, Brian De Palma Interviews. He goes, what possesses you to do this? How do you do this? And it's a great question, and I think he is so happy that you're interviewing him, because he doesn't get that comfort level from a lot of people interview him. He feels very liberated with you.
Yeah, he does seem to. And also with the other, there's several of us with websites on Brian De Palma. And in fact, Bill Fenton was the first one to interview, and Brian De Palma contacted him to interview him for Mission to Mars. And he said, I want the only interview for Mission to Mars to be on your website. And that was kind of what got the ball rolling on all that, and it was clear that De Palma just felt more comfortable being open and actually talking with people who were really appreciating the work.
No, that's very true. I remember that. Okay, so would you say Obsession is your all-time favorite?
No.
Okay, good, okay.
Actually, I have a trinity of films that are my favorites, and that's Phantom of the Paradise, Carrie, and Blowout.
Wow.
Very close to adding Femme Fatale to that list, but those three alternate between being my favorites at any given time.
Well, that's a great trinity to have. I couldn't think of a better trinity to have than that. But I have to say, with the exception of the late Pauline Kael and Armand White, Brian De Palma has gotten very little respect from the American film criticism community. I mean, he's like the Rodney Dangerfield of film directors, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Manola Dargis of the New York Times speaks highly of him, even so much that in an interview at Chud.com for the Black Dahlia, he even referred to her, hey, she's the critic that likes me. But many times he's been written off as a hack. Why is that? I mean, I think this is bloody unfair.
Yeah, I think, a lot of it is a lot of stuff you guys have kind of discussed earlier on the program is just a lot of people see him as pure style, and a lot of people see him as simply borrowing or stealing, they'll say, from other filmmakers. I got into an argument when it was announced that The Dress to Kill was going to be remade by MGM. Somebody had blogged something about how De Palma's Dress to Kill is all stolen from Hitchcock and all that. and I was discussing all the things that I thought were original in the work, and he shot back with, original? There is nothing original. Name me one thing that's, you know, original in De Palma. You know, this was borrowed from Hitchcock. The elevator scene is a direct ripoff of Psycho, and so on and so forth. And they don't really look at, like, say, the split screen sequence in Dressed to Kill, and where they're both watching the Donahue program.
Right.
And she's on the phone, and then she's putting on her makeup, and I mean, that's a brilliant sequence.
It is.
Nothing like that in Hitchcock.
No, there's not. And I have to say, actually, there's something very original about Dressed to Kill. It is one of the few times that the mother figure is seen in a very positive light, at least in De Palma's terms. Andy Dickinson does come off in a very positive way that Piper Laurie doesn't come off in Carrie, or that other of the De Palma mothers in future films have come off. So I have to say it's, you know, it's original. I mean, it owes, I think, something. I mean, he definitely pays homage, I think, to Hitchcock and Psycho, but not in a, you know, the ripoff way. But that leads me to my next question for you. His cinematic prodigy, his cinematic son, if you will, Quentin Tarantino, has been praised, and many of his comrades of this time, for their homages, while De Palma has just been attacked for it time and time again. Why do you think the younger directors get a free pass and De Palma got crucified for it?
I think it might be because the younger directors seem, they have, seems like a more of a youth following, where it's more younger people, I think, that are seeing the homages and kind of getting the jokes and kind of seeing, and it's kind of a DJ culture more nowadays, I think.
It is. That's a good point.
They're kind of seeing, you know, that that's what filmmakers are doing. And I think they get kind of a pass that way, and I think that a lot of the references are more obscure. And so a lot of the references you'll see in Tarantino, many critics simply might not know them and might not realize how much is being, you know, paid homage to or borrowing, so to speak.
True, but like someone like A.O. Scott in the New York Times, he knows exactly what Tarantino's referencing. You know, you read the reviews of Grind, especially like Death Proof, or the Kill Bills Volume 1 and 2, people at this point do see where it's coming from. I think it was the guy in the New York Magazine, Peter Raynor, said that basically Kill Bill is one of the greatest DJ mixtapes of all time. And, you know, I'm not going to argue with him there.
Yeah.
But I have to ask you, what was your experience like interviewing him? What was it like?
It was great. I interviewed him the first time in Paris, and he was very friendly and just very open. It was great. At one point, I don't know if I was nervous, or I mean, I'm sure I was a little bit, but at one point, his assistant offered him a cappuccino, and then Mr. De Palma asked me if I wanted anything, and I said, maybe just some water, and he pointed to the table where he had already laid out a whole bottle of water and a nice glass with ice right next to it on there, and I hadn't even noticed it the whole time, and it was just right there for me. So he was very welcoming and just wanted to make me feel at home, and he was, you know, it was awesome.
No, he seemed to understand. De Palma's one of the few directors of his generation, if we want to call it the film school generation. He and George Lucas sort of understand the internet and all the accolades and all the tributes that go along with that, all the things that you would that make that very and a very important next step in filmmaking. He seems to understand it also well, that he loves this younger audience that has found his work on your website and Split World and directed by Brian De Palma. I have to say, he's very candid with you and some of the younger guys on the websites. He's not candid. If you read that book, Brian De Palma Interviews, he's very cold for the establishment critics. He's not very revealing. But when he talks to you guys and when he talks to Tarantino, who he's basically talking to his ultimate fan, he'll tell him anything. I mean, I got this guy here who loves my work, Blowout's his favorite movie. This is great. Why couldn't I have gotten this in the 70s? You know he's thinking that. He's like, my God, I found a disciple. But he has a lot of faith in the technology, and I think his technical roots are, you know, he is very much the character he plays, you know, Keith Gordon plays in Dressed to Kill.
Yeah.
He identifies with him very strongly. and his use of the computer, his knowledge of that. In your opinion, has he done anything in the filmmaking field to push the technological envelope further?
Well, I would say he has. I would say he's very interested these days in all the technology that it kind of allows people to kind of film anything, basically. You know, cameras are smaller, and just being able to take them anywhere. And he's, in several interviews recently, he's questioned why aren't more filmmakers actually going out and doing more political films or doing
That's
more independent
right.
films. And I think with his next project, Redacted, I think he's going to kind of address that from the sound of it, where he's going to kind of mix up YouTube and soldiers who are going to have their own camera phones in Iraq and that sort of thing. So it'll be interesting to see where he takes that.
No, he will. I think he's going to, with that film, Redacted, which is about the murder, the murders in Haditha, if I'm not mistaken, that is the basic plot line, the U.S. Army murders in Haditha.
Yeah.
It's going to be, for De Palma, it could be the first time that in maybe something he wanted with Casualties of War and definitely something he wanted with the 60-era film, he is going to have a whole new audience with this film. He's
yeah.
going to have the very extreme left wing of the Democratic Party very interested in this film, I think, when it comes out in 2008. And my thing is there anyone... You know, he talks, obviously, he likes Tarantino, and I know he talked with you about the younger generation of filmmakers. Is there anyone that you think working today that's been influenced by his work?
Well, I think that, the name escapes me now, the guy who made Magnolia?
Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, he seems to me, I don't know for sure, but he seems to me like, I know he's inspired by Altman. But a lot of it also seems, I see some De Palma in him, too. Excuse me.
That's all right. What about someone like Christopher Nolan? Do you think that he shares any traits with De Palma?
I would say so. Maybe not so much in the camera work so much. Like, I watched Batman Begins, and there's so many cuts in that. And
right.
De Palma has been doing more cutting of late, but definitely not like I see in that film and even in The Prestige. But in something like The Prestige, the way that the movie kind of turns back on itself definitely seems very De Palma-esque.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We have, this is Jamie, by the way.
Okay.
We have our next guest up and ready to go, but before you go, Jeff, we have to ask you about your music.
Yes.
You're a very accomplished musician.
Thanks.
You know, do you have a... In terms of that, De Palma is known for such great kind of scores in his films. Do any of those kind of influence the way you write music, or have you used those as inspirations at all?
Definitely, because I mean that's part of what draws me to De Palma so much is his movies are like pieces of music brought to the screen. Basically, they're of course very operatic, but they're just like consistent pieces of music for 90
yeah.
minutes or 2 hours, and I've definitely been influenced, especially by Donaggio, it's definitely an influence.
Can you give us your De Palma a la mode, your website, how they find you on your website, and they can also link to your music on the same site as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the web address is www.angelfire.com/de/Palma.
Okay.
And you can link to my own website through there.
All right.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And go to your website. All those De Palma fans out there, it's a must visit on the web. So thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Great interview, Jerry. Great
thank
interview.
Thank you.
We actually have Mr. Finley on the line, and we have 10 minutes with him. So, Chris, would you like to go ahead and start on your intro for this for Mr. Finley?
Sure. Our next guest, William Finley, attended college with De Palma and was featured in De Palma's earliest cinematic efforts, including Murder a la Mode, The Wedding Party, and Sisters. De Palma also directed Mr. Finley in a lead role in Phantom of the Paradise, film that's inspired a large following and continues to thrill and captivate movie lovers more than 30 years after its initial release. Mr. Finley has also provided unforgettable work on the stage and in additional films like Eaten Alive, Silent Rage, and Night Terrors. Since Phantom of the Paradise, he's enjoyed collaborations with De Palma on The Fury, Dressed to Kill, and most recently in The Black Dahlia. It's our great pleasure to introduce to the show an exceptional character actor, Mr. William Finley.
Mr. Finley, are you there?
Yep.
Hi, thanks for being with us tonight.
Yeah,
sure, it was a treat. A treat to be here.
Thank you. Chris, the stage is all yours.
All right, thank you. Mr. Finley, can I ask you how your relationship with De Palma developed at Sarah Lawrence College? What was it that brought the two of you together?
Well, what brought us together was we originally went to Columbia College, and the year we went was the year the theater burned down. So we had nothing to, there was nothing at Columbia, literally, to do that originally got us to Columbia to begin with. So we decided that, we heard that Sarah Lawrence needed some male actors. At that time, it was a female school. And we headed up to Bronxville and proceeded to take over the theater department with the help of the main teacher there, who was named Wilfred Leach, who was, of course, the progenitor of Winslow and a big influence on Brian and myself. He was teaching film, teaching 16 millimeter, how to make films, how to act in films, history of films, things that we were really dying to find out about. And at that time in history, there was very little you could do to study these things. It's not like now where every school has a film program, and some are just dedicated to film itself. So basically, we started studying movies and plays, historic like Stravinsky and Yeats, and just wonderful theatrical masters together. And then came back to Columbia and started a drama club there, which then imported Sarah Lawrence to Columbia.
Oh, okay. And then you started making the short films with him. Like in the early days, you made the film, it's Wotan's Wake, is that
right?
Right,
right. Wotan's Wake is again, when you see it now, it looks rather strange. Then it looked rather amazing. It was like a real art film, but in the art film were satires of art films of the time, like Dolce Vita and Blow Up, for the first Antonioni, which I can't even remember the name of, had Phantom of the Opera in it, Godzilla. It's just a pastiche that made a lot of references through very obscure movies at the time. Wonderful movie.
At that time, was he already the sure-handed, uncompromising director that we know him to be now?
No, he was. He's stylistically, he's always had a really good idea of what he wanted to do, and that film was based on German Expressionism, black and white, very jagged edges, lighting, odd lighting, moving lighting, cracked mirrors. If you see it, you'd understand. It's very Caligari-like. So that's what got him going. The look of films, the way they look.
Well, that comes across.
It shows up in a lot of other of his films later on, including the last one, Black Dahlia.
It does. You're right. You've known him probably longer than anyone else in his professional career. How do his films reflect his personality?
They're very much like him. They have very cool exteriors. They usually have a heart in the middle of them. It is very, very open and warm. The look, of course. So he's very complicated, almost too complicated. I mean, I was listening to your last guest talk about, how critics rejected him. He They did seize upon his treatment of women and the supposed borrowings from Hitchcock, but when you get right down to it, even if you look at Sisters, which is obviously, you know, influenced heavily by Hitchcock, they're not the same things. As there's a psycho-like killing, but that's as far as it gets. There's nothing about a Siamese twin ever in Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they sort of
absolutely
seized on this thing and stuck it to him for his whole career, which I think was unfair.
Oh, very unfair.
And now it's, of course, everybody's supposed to go out and borrow from everybody.
Yeah.
So it's a different thing. But then they literally pasted him over with this. And every picture they tried to find out what he might have borrowed from something. So it became like the tagline for De Palma, much to his regret. I mean, it's just, it's a shame.
Yeah, it's really unfair.
Because I think he's one of the most original, certainly of that era, filmmakers. There's nobody who makes films except maybe Marty.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese, who's given anything to films that took them forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask you. You mentioned Sisters, which you of course were in, but right after Sisters in 1974 was The Phantom of the Paradise.
Right.
And the film has, first of all, let me say that I love the film.
Great.
And it has this gigantic cult following, and
yep.
Specifically in Winnipeg, where we received these really excited emails from some fans of the movie that are telling us that Winnipeg, they have a festival for the movie. They love the movie.
Of course, it's self-serving, but the Winnipeg people are what are the audience that were supposed to be for the film. They're supposed to be nationwide for the film. I mean, they were very intelligent. They got the references. They were hooked by the story. They didn't think it was a farce. They didn't think it was ridiculous. They loved the music, because Winnipeg's a big music town for Canada, the biggest probably. And it's so heartwarming to get that appreciation from people. That, you know, what you put into it, finally, 25 years, 30 years later, it comes back to you.
Right.
So my problem with that is that I never got Brian to go up there so he could feel it. Mm. All he's had is the fans in France, you know, the adulation in France.
Right.
Where, you know, standing ovations for Brian. But he's never had it in America or close to America.
No, it's sad.
And it's very sad. But I couldn't get him to come up. He didn't want to for some reason.
So, but you went.
Oh, yeah. Well, the whole cast went.
Yeah.
The second year of Fantapalooza, the whole cast went up there, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, and they all had a really good time. I mean, they were all shocked how much fun it was.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it was like Beatlemania. I can't explain it. It sounds absolutely crazy, but people are standing on their seats screaming.
Oh, we believe it.
I believe it.
It's unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. But boy, what a thrill.
We were speaking earlier about his earlier films, Greetings, Hi Mom, and how they were mostly comedic and satirical. And
right.
Do you notice the presence of that comedy and the satire in his films still?
Yeah. I think that one of the biggest things he gave to horror, or the genre, he's not really a horror director, but in his early years he was supposed to be a horror director, the master of the macabre.
Right.
But his thing was really quite wonderful. In those days, nobody laughed at a horror film. You laughed at them sometimes, but you never laughed during them. There was never intentionally, you know, the closest thing was Igor and the James Whale, you know, Frankensteins.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But never were you supposed to go to a horror film and find anything ridiculous. And so in Sisters, we did a cleanup scene. It was like a commercial. You know, a very bloody murder. It's like someone coming in after Psycho and doing a cleanser commercial. I mean, he took, you know, a long time doing this. A lot of screen time watching somebody clean up a murder.
Right.
With we used every kind of product we could think of. It was a lot of fun, and we were laughing all the time, and it was very funny.
You were in his first feature film, in Murder a la Mode.
Yeah.
And you were in his most recently released film, The Black Dahlia.
Right.
So, how how do you see that he's changed as a filmmaker over the years?
Well, now he has. In those days, he was just a kid, and he didn't have the respect. You know, he had to prove himself with the crew every time.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's literally like a master that comes on the set. You know, it's like Fellini comes in the room, and nobody's saying, "Well, shouldn't you put the camera over there?" Or, you know, "Wouldn't it be better if we mic'd it here?" Or, "How about if we cut the scene there?" You know, "Well, it's going on too long. Why don't we drop this tracking shot? It's costing too much." None of that now. I mean, if there are any kind of those battles, they're all behind the scenes before the film is made. You know what the costs are, and he's got very good producers, so they fend off any problems. So he's much more relaxed. You know, he can deal with the actors. He can joke, which is unheard of. In the beginning, he never joked about anything because it was too hard to keep all the balls in the air. I mean, one of the hardest things about directing is just finding out where every little thing goes and keeping it in your mind. So now he can sort of keep it in his mind. He doesn't even use storyboards anymore, hardly at all.
Hmm. Really?
The last one I remember that was really heavily storyboarded was Mission Impossible, where he knew where all the slide points are, all the big adventure points were, and they were heavily storyboarded.
Hmm. So what about with actors? Does he enjoy working with actors?
Working with actors. He, has actors return to do parts for him over and over. He's very comfortable with actors. I haven't been on a set when he's had a difficult time with an actor in a long time.
What about ad-libbing? I mean, happy accidents and things like that. Does he allow for that during the
I would say less, but I'm sure on something like Redacted, he's fine with the accidents. See, Redacted is another, he's going back to the rehearsals,
mm-hmm.
where he's all ready to shoot. He's got the scene ready to go. They all know everything about the scene that there is, and they've improvised whatever they're going to add to it.
How does he direct? Is it through suggestion, or is there a lot of detailed talk about crafting the character, or
if an actor needs that, he'll go do it. He'll sit down. He'll go work with Josh Harnett if he has questions about how to do some like a major part. They'll go over it as carefully as they want, or any direction he wants to go.
Right.
But generally, he lets people do what they do as long as they know what marks they have to hit and where the camera's going.
Right.
Now, what about the two of you? Do you guys have kind of a shorthand on the set? You've known each other for so long and worked together so often.
Yeah, I can tell when he didn't like a take before he even says he doesn't like the take.
Right.
You know, you can tell how quick he's moving, how tired he is, or I wouldn't say there's a code, but there's definitely, once you've worked with him, you have an idea of how he works and what he wants.
Oh, yeah. I know this is the last question we got to ask. I know it's hard to be objective because you've been in so many of them, but
yeah.
Do you have a favorite De Palma film?
I've been watching Untouchables over and over. I can't, you know, it's like one of those films. I mean, I'm a sucker for things like Die Hard.
Right.
Where you can sort of go in at any time and watch it and have a good time. You don't have to start from the beginning and sit there in front of your tube and watch a whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think at the moment my favorite is Untouchables because it just, you can go in anywhere in that movie and it's good anywhere.
There's a lot of great dialogue in that film.
I mean, a lot of people don't like it that much, but I think it's a wonderful.
Oh, I love it.
Absolutely wonderful. And it's in the whole, it has his new stuff and his old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just got everything in it. You know, it's like, I wish he could make more of them. I wish, you know, they would write things that were as good as that.
Right.
And he would direct everything as good as that. Cause
right.
Boy, he would be incredible. I mean, just so amazing if it was possible to do. I don't know anybody who's gotten it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody of that generation who's continued. Brian's doing pretty good.
He absolutely has.
Yes,
it's just astonishing.
He's very much survived, and he's still so vital. And
yeah, the bad part is the critics. That's why he just never got that.
They stick on something, the critics, and especially in this country, and they just, you know, it's like almost like, okay, memo, when a Brian De Palma film comes out, say this, and, you know.
Right.
It's sad and unfair.
Well, you know, and the other ridiculous thing is, if anybody needs a lifetime award from an Oscar kind of thing, it's him. You know, I think Marty, obviously, Spielberg, obviously. Coppola's gotten it already.
Yeah, but he does.
But he deserves something, and he's not getting it.
No, he's not. It's bad.
I'd be so shocked.
We wanted to give him a little of it tonight. I mean,
well, that's good. I'm glad you guys are keeping it up. I mean, the websites, too. The websites are wonderful.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we have one of the top critics in the country with us. In just a moment, he's on the line, and he's a big De Palma devotee. So
who do you got?
Mr. Armand White.
Oh, Armand. Well, great.
Yeah.
Say hello.
So we're all united here.
Yeah. Okay, good.
De Palma.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Finley.
Okay.
And you're welcome back on the show anytime.
Well, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Great interview, Chris.
Great interview. That's Mr. William Finley. Okay, are we ready for our last guest and the show? Okay, we conclude tonight's program with one of the most interesting, outspoken, and fearless of film critics. His criticism, which has been featured in the pages of the New York Press for the past decade, is remarkably insightful and beautifully written, recalling the work of one of his mentors and one of our most legendary film critics, Pauline Kael. And like Kael, he has a particular affinity for the work of Brian De Palma. Of De Palma's 2000 release, Mission to Mars, he wrote, "Any reviewer who pans the film does not understand movies, let alone like them." And that explains why I love our next guest. He is a member of the New York Film Critics Circle and the National Society of Film Critics. In addition to his film criticism, he has also written about music for The Nation and has won an ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for Music Criticism. He is the author of The Resistance, 10 Years of Pop Culture That Shook the World, and Rebel for the Hell of It, The Life of Tupac Shakur. And I believe he's currently working on a book on De Palma's works titled Total Illumination. It is a pleasure to welcome to the show one of our great voices in modern film criticism, Mr. Armand White. Mr. White?
Good evening.
Hi.
Good evening.
Thank you for joining us tonight. This is a great honor for us.
I'm pleased that you ask and happy to participate.
Thank you. Now, it seems that if you're vocal in your love and appreciation of film and you champion De Palma's work in any way, you should prepare yourself for some kind of adversarial reaction. And we've even gotten it promoting this show. We've been met by a certain amount of protest. What do you think it is about De Palma's work that his naysayers find so disagreeable and almost offensive?
Well, I guess the quote that you just read earlier that I said about Mission to Mars is actually, well, that explains it. But let me say that actually that's a quote that I recycled from an earlier opinion I wrote on The Fury.
Mm-hmm.
The Fury, I think, being the quintessential Brian De Palma film. That's the film that first brought me to say that if you don't get what Brian De Palma is doing in this movie, meaning The Fury, then you really do have an antipathy for cinema as a kinetic, sensual, and intellectual art form. And that's how I felt in 1978. Unfortunately, it's how I feel, it's what I feel is wrong with most criticism today. Just to pick up on the line that William Finley said, that the only problem being the critics. Yeah, I'm afraid that's true, but I don't even think the people who don't understand Brian De Palma deserve to be called critics.
Mm-hmm.
They're non-believers, but also they're not interested in film as art.
Yeah, and they seem to be so. They seem to have an arsenal of things that they pull out of their briefcase to kind of dismiss his work, whether it's the Hitchcock comparison or the style over substance argument. But of course, Pauline Kael and yourself have been vocal defenders of his work. What do you get about De Palma's work that others don't seem to grasp?
Well, I would say that it's based on the basic thing that draws you to movies as an art form, which is moving pictures, which is kineticism. And then from there, I think an affection and a fascination with that particular art form.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's anything that simply describes how Brian De Palma works, it's that he is primarily a visual filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That it seems a strange thing to say, because what else would a filmmaker be? But he is a true filmmaker, and he believes in making movies that you can look at, not necessarily movies with clever dialogue that you can respond to, but movies whose images affect you viscerally and intellectually. He's superb at that. These days, too many people think that a movie is just a conventional plot and snappy dialogue. They don't bother to look at films and to even think about how the images in a movie can be expressive
mm-hmm.
of ideas, expressive of situations, expressive about character. De Palma always does that, and I'm afraid if people aren't attuned to watching movies in that way, then when they look at a De Palma film, they just simply don't get it.
Yeah, I don't you find that it's possibly a level of laziness in their approach to watching movies?
It is lazy, I guess, but also then, in a way, it's understandable because, again, to respond to what William Finley said, you have to consider that people have that so many moviegoers watch movies after having read bad criticism,
yeah.
after having read criticism that doesn't instruct them on visual literacy, mm-hmm. on how to look at a movie and appreciate its images. And so they go to a Brian De Palma film, and since it's not knocked out, since it doesn't work primarily, since it isn't a primarily verbal experience,
right.
they don't get it. And that's the fault, I think, of criticism. It's a fault in our contemporary film culture.
You even discussed, I believe, in one of the interviews I read, where I think you were in school, and a great inspiration for you was you were made to watch films without the volume, and it became an even more enriching experience because the story unfolded solely through the images. And do you think that that's the strength of De Palma's work as well?
That's certainly a strength, and yeah, I imagine anyone listening to this show or anyone who's familiar with the website certainly knows that the great sequences and the most memorable sequences in a Brian De Palma film are usually the sequences without dialogue,
mm-hmm.
the sequences that simply work visually. Let me just clarify one thing about being in film school. I'm very happy to have gone to film school. I went to Columbia. And I went to Columbia Film Department when it was a great thing, and I got a lot out of it. And particularly, there was a course by Stefan Scharf called Analysis of Film Language, where Scharf would actually show a film. He had a stop motion projector. I think that's how it operated, where he could show a film frame by frame, and he taught us that films could be read visually. And actually, it was while I was taking that course, and I accidentally discovered that if I watched a movie on television with the sound off, I would be able to see the things that Scharf was illustrating in his class.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to do that because one of Scharf's primary texts would be Hitchcock movies. And I discovered on my own, while I was a film student, that if you watch a Hitchcock film with the sound off, you understand them entirely. You don't need the dialogue. And subsequently, Brian De Palma's films passed that test superbly.
Yeah, and that brings up the Hitchcock comparison, especially in De Palma's work in the suspense genre. How do you think De Palma's suspense films kind of break away from what Hitchcock did in the same genre and kind of transcend convention in a way?
Well, De Palma acknowledges the existence of Hitchcock's art as part of his cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm.
But I hasten to say, not only Hitchcock. And I'm so tired of Hitchcock being brought up as something to criticize against De Palma.
Yeah.
But because Hitchcock is not the only part of film heritage that De Palma has inherited or acknowledges. There are other great filmmakers on his mind, and you can see the influence of other great filmmakers in his work. Probably lazy critics and lazy moviegoers only see Hitchcock,
mm-hmm.
But there are others there, from Orson Welles to Jean-Luc Godard.
Godard, yeah.
If you're familiar with their works, you can see their influence on De Palma. If De Palma breaks away from Hitchcock, it's simply due to the fact that he comes from a later generation, and so he responds to Hitchcock movies the way a later generation would. And the way he responds to me is crucial. It's crucial that we understand that Brian De Palma comes from a generation of modernist filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
So he's able to respond to Hitchcock not simply through imitation, but in a form of conversation. He starts out with a Hitchcock. He may start out with a Hitchcock or a Orson Welles trope, stylistic mannerism, and he gives it different meaning. He gives it new meaning, all the while clearly alluding to it. So he isn't simply imitating it. He's acknowledging it and then commenting upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an essential way that modernist filmmakers of the 1960s era would respond to their movie heritage. And I'm afraid that a lot of moviegoers and critics have probably lost that awareness that this modern response to film heritage is legitimate and can be a step towards making original and meaningful art.
Yeah.
And that's how De Palma operates. He isn't simply imitating Hitchcock. He's responding to Hitchcock and is in conversation with Hitchcock's legacy.
Yeah, and saying that he did come up in the 60s, and I think a major component of understanding De Palma and his films are to look at some of those early films. There's a lot of humor and satirical qualities in his films that I think are so largely overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see those kind of illustrated in his later works, in his suspense films or his gangster films? How do you see that those themes coming out?
Well, there are two. I see two aspects of De Palma's work. One is I see several aspects of his work. One is the modernist artist, the modernist art consumer. The other is a moralist as well. I think his films are always about the crisis of living in a chaotic universe where things are not always fair, where death is often lurking. And the third aspect would be that he's a humorist. He's a satirist, most of all. And his humor is always there. Some of his earliest and in fact, most easily enjoyable films are comedies. People tend to forget that, but the man has a satirical mind. And that's always apparent in his work, I think. And another aspect of that satirical mind is apparent in the way the glee in which he makes reference to his film heritage. He doesn't simply use tropes and motifs from Hitchcock and Orson Welles and Godard because he doesn't have any original ideas. I think he uses them because he loves them and is tickled by them and gets pleasure from them. Gets a kind of comic release from them, and so he uses them. And if you're hip to that kind of thing, that's part of the humor that you see in De Palma.
Yeah, yeah.
Such as the opening, the girls' locker room scene in Carrie.
Yeah,
that's a particular kind of modernist satire because it's clearly a reference to Psycho, the shower scene in Psycho,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a dull reference to Psycho.
Not at all.
It's a bemused reference to Psycho. And then even more than that, it's a kind of erotic tease as well. And then even more than that, it gets deeply into the psyche of Carrie as in her experience of being a pubescent girl and having an awareness of what her blooming sexuality means in the context, in a social context, in fact. It's a very rich sequence, but it's a little scary. It's erotic, and it's also funny.
Yeah, and that's what we were discussing a little bit earlier on the show. There are all these emotions, particularly in the scenes in Carrie. We were talking about it earlier, where you're feeling terrified, and it's funny at the same time and deeply moving. And I don't think audiences are used to being programmed to know exactly what to feel at any given time, and so De Palma can be very challenging for that kind of moviegoer.
Very challenging, I agree. And I say the challenge is even more stressful for some moviegoers today because the lessons of the modernist era were not carried on by other film critics. And so people don't understand. Too many people don't understand that you can watch a movie and be affected on more than one level,
mm-hmm.
which is right. Certainly the case with the work of any modern artist. You may respond to the story as it's simply being told, but you're also responding to the way the story is being told within the context of film history. And so to be able to watch a story and follow its meaning, to be able to watch a story and understand how it is in conversation with film history is probably too complicated for folks who read critics like, or who follow critics like Roger Ebert or most of the mainstream film publications, film outlets.
Right. Now there seems to be two De Palmas. There's the one that makes the very personal films in the suspense genre that we've discussed, and then there's the big studio kind of director for hire projects he has, like Mission Impossible or The Untouchables. Do you find that those kinds of situations somehow compromise his unique quality, or do you think he functions best when he's on the outside?
Well, I have to disagree with you a little bit there. I don't think there are two De Palmas. I think there's only one.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always making movies his way. He's achieved insists upon a level of, autonomy, where he only makes the movies he wants to make. And if he ever did a film for hire, and I don't think he ever simply did a film for hire, he still makes it his way.
Right.
With an example like Mission to Mars or The Untouchables, those might seem like studio productions, but they turn out to be Brian De Palma films because he always makes the films his way.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think there's only one Brian De Palma. Always the same man, and always an artist who insists on doing films his way.
Scarface is one of his films that has endured and grown in popularity, mm-hmm. probably more so than anything on his resume. What do you attribute to its continued popularity? And do you think the perception is consistent with why it's a great film?
Well, I think I think you were asking William Finley a question, and you asked about Happy Accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here, in a different way, is an example of a happy accident. Brian De Palma, with Scarface, made a film that uniquely had a kind of social relevance. And that was proven by the way it was responded to by a particular audience, the hip-hop audience. I don't think he intentionally made a movie that would do that. It was a happy accident that it did.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, I think it was an accident. And it's good that he had that kind of success on his resume, so then he was able to follow Scarface with what might look to be a more personal film, Body Double.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his personality is apparent in both those movies. It's part of the fascination, frankly, of dealing with an artist who works in a popular medium.
Yeah.
An artist who works in a popular art form will sometimes luck upon a hit, a film that connects with the public in a different way. That doesn't mean that Scarface is De Palma's greatest film, and it doesn't mean that it's necessarily an impersonal film on his part. He just had the luck of making a film that connected with the public in ways that his other films did not.
Have you seen kind of a maturation in his work? Because I'm thinking Mission of Mars and Femme Fatale. I rewatched Mission of Mars a few weeks ago, and it was extraordinarily moving mm-hmm. to me, that film. And very kind of, I felt very kind of hopeful at the end of it. It seemed like life-affirming as well. And I think that he found an element of happiness or redemption in Femme Fatale as well. How have you seen his work mature over the years? What kind of arc do you see taking place?
I would agree with that, and I think if there is a difference, I think it's the kind of difference that we can recognize, that we usually recognize in the work of in the work of more serious artists, such as novelists.
right.
That is, as De Palma has matured, he becomes more concerned with the things that people are concerned with as they age,
mm-hmm.
which is mortality. He was always an artist who appreciated life, who appreciated politics, and who appreciated how how complex it is to live in the modern world. But I think his latest films have shown a profound appreciation of mortality. He's always made movies that in some way deal with death, usually satirically, especially at the beginning, and in kind of the peak period, 70s and 80s movies. But the awareness of death, the awareness of mortality in the later films is stronger. And it happens to be stronger as his craft as a filmmaker has also, not peaked, but just become peerless in a way.
Right.
The sense of mortality in Mission to Mars and Femme Fatale, the appreciation of what life means, and even, I think, the spiritual aspect of life happens, it seems to spring up naturally in movies like Mission to Mars, and especially in Femme Fatale, and the great, great final sequence of Femme Fatale, which too few people have sat in their seats to actually look at and study. That's all about spirituality.
Yes, it is.
The ray of light in that final tableau.
Yes.
But too few people have actually sat still and looked at it.
Well, we're about to run out of time, but there's one film that we have not brought up this evening, and I wanted to give your thoughts, get your thoughts on it, because I think it's one of the most powerful films in his resume, and that is Casualties of War. What were your thoughts on that film?
Oh, I think that's one of the very good ones, and I guess it shows De Palma in what some people would call a more serious mode than his other films, probably less satire in that film than in some of his others.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it is. That's what you've got. He's also responding to a part of American history that was very important for his generation, the Vietnam War, and what it means in terms of the morality and politics of people.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes Casualties of War a very fascinating movie.
And just it feels like an open wound of a movie, and you get that sense of it more so, I do anyway, more so than any of the other films that were made around the same time that dealt with Vietnam. And it seems like the one film that kind of gets pushed to the side among those Vietnam films, like so much of De Palma's work, and I just think that's terribly unfair.
Sure, and you know, I was constantly reminded of Casualties of War while watching Werner Herzog's Rescue Dawn. In fact, I think the sense of Southeast Asia as a place of chaos and fear in those two films were particularly convincing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is too bad. I agree with you. It is too bad that people who talk about the Vietnam movies don't talk about Casualties of War, because it's certainly one of the very best.
It deserves to be there.
Yeah. Pardon me?
It deserves to be mentioned in the...
Oh, sure. Oh, it's a far superior film to Apocalypse Now. Let's be plain about that. In every way.
Now, you're currently writing a book on De Palma, correct?
Yeah, I've been working on it for a while.
When can we expect it? What kind of progress are you making on it?
Well, God willing, you'll see it within a year.
Well, we will be the first in line to buy it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have an open invitation to come back on our show anytime a film strikes your fancy, or you want to discuss any films, or when your book comes out, to come back and talk to us.
Well, thank you very much. I'll do that.
Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For being on our show.
Thank
it's been
you.
A tremendous treat.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for carrying the torch.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Armand White, he is one of our finest and most fearless of film critics, like I just mentioned, and a great guest and a great dialogue about De Palma's work. Well, gentlemen, have you enjoyed the show?
It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Chris, are you still with us?
I am still here. I'm just enjoying. I could listen to Armand White talk for a long time.
Yeah, isn't it? Don't you kind of wish that you didn't have the... have to carry on an interview, that you could just kind of sit back.
Yeah, I know. Just talk to him.
Just absorb everything and just, you know.
I just kind of feel vindicated, you know, like hearing, you know, a renowned critic defend De Palma, you know. So I feel like I don't have to anymore.
Yeah. And it's that's part of what we want to do with this show. We wanted, you know, quite a few people, not from our MySpace community, but outside, said, why De Palma? And there are real reasons why De Palma's fans love his work. And we wanted to explore that and explore why his works are so often misunderstood. He's a complicated man. He's a complicated director. And I think that people are accustomed to easy when they sit down and watch a movie. And De Palma, you can't be categorized and can't be dismissed like that. And we're just so honored to bring you the show tonight and illustrate that. Gentlemen, that's it for our Brian De Palma tribute. Join us on Wednesday night, where we have an exciting lineup of guests, and including the director of a new documentary called Your Mommy Kills Animals. We can't wait for that. That's going to be an exciting conversation. And we'll replay our interview with the director and an original member of the Camden 28, which, of course, opens up this coming Friday in New York City. We're signing off, and thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to our show by iTunes. Just look up Movie Geeks United on the iTunes website, and all of our shows will pop up. It's free. Click subscribe, and then download all of our previous shows that are there in the menu there. I'm Jamie. And
I'm Jerry.
And I'm Chris. It's been great.
And thank you so much, everyone, for listening in and joining us. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.